Welcome to the Brown County Hour.
Coming to you from the legendary hills of Brown.
Where the plum purple haze,
the one nature herself drapes over the hills and hollers,
inspires local characters, artists, and nature lovers.
It's as though the hills themselves conspire to create a beauty and a culture in the heart of Indiana.
Sit for a spell and hear the music.
The tall tales.
True stories.
And current goings on.
Brought to you by folks who still know how to sit by a fire in winter.
And swim buck naked in summer.
Welcome to episode 41 of the Brown County Hour. This is Dave Seastrom along with the rest of the crew, and it's our pleasure to present our latest show.
Last month, our musical guests were Lucky and the Kid featuring Dan Bilger and Barry Elkins. In a first for the Brown County Hour, this month, Barry is back with his daughter Heather Dawn Elkins and her partner Gabrielle Steinberger. And together, they're known as the Boxcar Annies.
Jeff Tryon returns with another edition of My Brown County, and Dave Seastrom shares another essay.
We have the latest edition of For a Song from Carrie Ray, and arborist Rick Patrick discusses forest management.
We have poems from Gunther Flum and Carol Marks. Ruth Ann Ingram informs us about invasive plants and will share the community calendar.
We begin with Jeff Tryon and the latest in his series, My Brown County.
We have our interview with the Boxcar Annies, and we'll listen to one of their songs.
And Dave Seastrom talks about the weather.
This is My Brown County with Jeff Tryon. The more I thought about what really makes Brown County, Brown County, the more I began to realize how we each have our own particular Brown County. In a way, Brown County is what we each bring to it, what we find there for our own, what we each make of it. No one else sees it probably in the same exact way that I do. That's what makes it my Brown County. Stolen watermelons. Driving through Bean Blossom one summer day, I saw old Bud Smith sitting out there with his wagon full of watermelons and cantaloupes, so I stopped by and bought one. These melons are grown right down the hill in the Bean Blossom Creek bottom. Were probably picked today or yesterday. A lady at the roadside tent assured me she had just sampled one and they were sweet as sugar. And it was. I asked Bud, "Do the kids ever steal watermelons out of your patch?" I honestly just wondered if kids today still had the energy and initiative. "Yeah, they steal them sometimes," he said, more sad than angry. Sounded kind of disappointed. A few months ago, he said, a fella came up to me at Brownie's restaurant and he said, "Are you Bud Smith?" I said, "Yeah." He says, "Back in 1989, a friend and I came and stole some cantaloupes out of your field and we sat on the schoolhouse steps and ate them." He said, "I never did feel right about that, and it still bothers me every time I drive past there." And he put a $5 bill down there on the table. I said, "It's okay, you don't need to pay me," but he said he'd feel better if he did. Bud said, "About that time the waitress came, and she reckoned as how if nobody else wanted that five, it would make a nice tip." Anyway, it reminded me of a story Dad used to tell about him and some boys stealing watermelons around this time of year. They were poor as Abe Martin and twice as ornery. Dad was a twin, so double dose of hijinks was involved. He and his brother tended to have big ideas and get into things. They weren't thieves or criminal in any sense of the word. They were raised by a very strict moral example. Except for this particular vice, actually more of a sport, of sneaking into a local farmer's watermelon patch in late summer and snagging a few ripe beauties for a watermelon feast at the old barn later. Ah, youth. They would slip down the dark lane, trying not to alert the farm dogs, slip through the barbed wire fence into Farmer McGregor's capacious field of juicy, sweet melons. About the time they had selected a nice ripe specimen, snipping it from its umbilical vine with their ever-present old-timer pocket knives, the old hound dogs would start barking and raising the alarm up at the farmhouse. Often, as the little bandits scurried away, each clutching their purloined prize, the old farmer would come out on the porch and fire off the 12-gauge a couple of times, but luckily for me, he never managed to kill Dad. Now, they were young kids, maybe 8 or 9 years old. They already worked in the fields for their father, who would make a contract to raise tomatoes for the canning factory. That was an all-hands-on-deck family survival type thing. But by the time they were teenagers, they were seeking additional work, paying work, outside the family to buy their own shoes and school clothes. The family was large and desperately poor. And, of course, one of the places they worked was for old Farmer McGregor, who had a big spread with a little bit of everything and hired help for planting, haying, and harvesting from among the local youth. One day, while they were working with him in the spring, planting gardens for produce, the farmer told them to go down in the rich bottom field next to the road and plant watermelons. And he indicated that they should plant it all in watermelons, over an acre of them. "Why do you grow so many watermelons?" asked my dad. "Do you sell that many watermelons in a season?" "Oh, no," said the old farmer. "But I plant a lot of extras so that the local boys can come down in the middle of the night and steal a few of them." "Really?" Dad asked with what must have been a guilty tone. "Oh, yeah," said the farmer. "Sometimes I run out and fire the shotgun off a couple of times just to add to the sense of danger. But I'm not really aiming at them," he said with a conspiratorial smile. So, the farmer apparently staged this elaborate ritual of providing free watermelons to those bold enough to take them, but also a lesson learned early about the probable reactions of the victims of such petty crimes. The Russian poet Yevtushenko wrote, "Stolen apples always taste better." And he wasn't just being a good commie, either. No, Yevtushenko was speaking to a basic, universal human desire to get something for nothing, for an unexpected and perhaps forbidden pleasure, for the idea that not just the political state, but God himself has decreed and ordained that everything belongs to everybody. I couldn't help wondering if Bud's melons would taste even sweeter if I slipped back over there under cover of darkness and carried one away. And then I wondered if old Bud still has a shotgun. Well, you sure have to consider all the angles when you're living in my brown county.
It's our pleasure to have the Boxcar Annies with us this evening. And Barry Elkins is a member of the band, and he's going to introduce everybody else for us.
We have Gabrielle and my daughter, Heather. And they are the Boxcar Annies.
So tell me about the name, Boxcar Annies. How did that come about?
I think that's thanks to my mother. We went out one night, my parents and I, and my dad ordered a Moscow Mule. And my mom couldn't remember the name of the drink he ordered and called it a Boxcar Annie. And immediately I was like, that's a great band name. So I texted Heather and she's like, I love it. So it stuck.
There you go. So how long have you known each other? You guys sound like you're joined at the hip.
Well, it's kind of funny how that happened. We actually met at a party, festival, whatever you want to call it, about a year ago. And we were and have been inseparable since. She's my best friend.
Aww. Aww.
Well, we've really enjoyed your music. This has been tremendous. And I believe you've just treated us to 5 original tunes. Is that correct?
Yes.
So both you guys write?
Yes.
Oh, that's wonderful. So, do you have a Facebook page? Do you have a website?
We do. We have a Facebook page. You can go on the Boxcar Annies, and you can also find it through my page and through Heather's page. So,
What is your last name?
Steinberger.
Dad.
Steinberger or Steinberger?
Steinberger. You know
Steinberger.
That.
Okay.
Well, Gabriel Steinberger.
Gabriel. Sorry, I'm more of a Gabriel.
Gabriel blows his horn. You play the fiddle. I get the distinction.
We're both angels. I know it's hard to differentiate.
Well, there's the archangel.
And yeah, I know.
There's like, I don't know what the others are.
Just a regular
lesser angel. Or a rank and file angel.
We'll try again.
And, right, and then the fallen angels.
That's
exactly.
Not me.
And then there's us.
Might be Heather. I'm just kidding.
Me.
She gives me a look.
Gabriel Steinberger.
Gabrielle.
Gabrielle.
It's like Gabriella.
I'll never get it right.
Just think Gabriella.
Put that little mark over your A.
Gab, long name.
No.
Gabriella.
Gab. That's a soft A.
Gabrielle.
There you go.
See, I got it there.
There you go.
Gabriel Steinberger.
Steinberg.
See, that's why I got to quit.
I've even got it spelled out.
Don't make me come out.
Meaner than a snake. All right. I'm going to try again.
Okay. We're ready.
Right. Gabriel Steinberger. I heard you say that you've been playing the fiddle since you were 5.
Yes, I started classical violin when I was 5, and I picked up a little bit of bluegrass here and there when I was about 14. Played in Bloomington a lot, and then I came here to Brown County.
Well, this begs the question, how old are you now?
I'm 18.
What about you, Heather Elkins? How old are you?
I will be 21 in November.
There you go. Almost legal.
The older
yes.
statesman.
I'm excited to hopefully maybe sit in with my dad at the Wine Fest next year.
There you go. Well, obviously you come from a musical family, and I assume your dad probably had some influence on you becoming a musician. I know you sing beautifully. We just watched all of that. I think you also play some guitar, do you?
I do. I kind of picked it up when I was about 13. I know the basics on guitar. I feel more comfortable singing, though, than playing.
And you don't have to tune any strings. That's kind of handy.
Yeah, I got my built-in tuner.
Do you have any gigs lined up?
We talked about maybe trying to get a gig at the Players Club in Bloomington and the Mike's Dance Barn on 46, maybe trying to get one there. We're really trying to work on an album right now.
Okay. So if you do snag one of those gigs, you're going to put it on your Facebook page. And we'll
I keep everything very updated on the Facebook. I'm very loud about our events. We are at the Pine Room Tavern quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
If you walk in there, you'll always find music, and sometimes it's us. So we like to hang out there.
That's a great venue. Well, what's next for you guys? You're going to make a CD. Is that it?
We are. Hopefully, you know, within the month, we'll have what we need to do that, because we have had many ask us, you know, do you guys have CDs yet? And we don't, but we are working on it.
So where will you record? What have you done so far?
Barry is our jack of all trades. He gets us pretty much wherever we need to go. We always joke that we're the Annies and he and Picker Dan are the boxcar. They take us where we need to go. I think the guys have something in mind. We're not quite sure yet.
Well, the transportation is important.
I'd say Farm Fresh is where I'm going to try to take them over and see Jake.
There you go.
That's the plan anyway.
Let's talk about some of the tunes you guys just did for us. Good Old Brown County. Heather, I believe you wrote that one.
I did. That was actually the first song I ever wrote for the Boxcar Annies.
Well, talk about it a little bit.
Well, it's about my hometown, Brown County, and it's a very special place to my heart. And in the song, I talk about how there's no other place I'd rather be. You know, there's Florida and California and all these nice places with nice weather all the time. But there's honestly no place I'd rather be than Brown County, just because of the community and the people and the music and just the feeling that I have when I'm here.
Thank you.
Sometimes living in Brown County feels like being on the edge of the frontier. We certainly have the wilderness to remind us that nature's really in charge, but that's not what I'm talking about. Because of our terrain and the large number of trees in the county, we often experience prolonged power outages. Nothing strips away the thin veneer of civilization like losing power. We lose power often enough that most of us have some kind of backup plan. My wife and I don't have a generator, although many people in Brown County do. We have flashlights and water. We also have kerosene lamps when the batteries run out. Our gas range doesn't require electricity, so we can always prepare a meal. In the winter, we heat with firewood. Because of these measures, we can take care of ourselves, and I think most folks in the area can say the same. We've been having an unusually wet summer, and so has most of the Midwest. I'm pretty sure it's better to be wet than dry, but there are consequences to all of this rainfall. The highway department has done a valiant job of keeping the roads graded, but our steep hills defy proper maintenance. Once the storms roll in, our roads become torrents of moving water, and it doesn't take long before they're rutted out. After a few days of rain, we start losing trees when the wind blows. These conditions are exactly what we're facing right now. After many days of continuous rain, on July 13, 2015, Brown County received heavy rains during the middle of the day and then again in the evening. As a result, there was widespread flooding. The county council declared a disaster and imposed travel advisories. Events like this bring out the best in people, and there are many stories of people helping each other out during these hard times. For many of us, deciding to live in Brown County means we're willing to take responsibility for ourselves and to be willing to pitch in when our neighbors need help. We have to, because there simply isn't enough emergency services to go around, especially when something big happens. When windstorms take down a number of trees, the sounds of chainsaws fill the air as neighbors pitch in to clear the roads and driveways. This happens frequently on our road. We know that we're at the far end of the county and that the highway department will be a long time getting here. Some of us make firewood and we all have chainsaws, so it only makes sense to work together to clear out the road when the time comes. Many of us have four-wheel drive vehicles. Rough roads and steep terrain makes it difficult to get around during rainstorms and snowfall. Low-slung city cars won't get you very far. I always carry a chain in my truck. This is another example of being prepared to help someone if they need it, or to pull a log out of the road. For the most part, we live in the 21st century, just like everyone else. We have cell phones, computers, and satellite dishes. Our houses are equipped with central air and heat, and almost everyone has a refrigerator. There's even a big grocery store in town where we can acquire most of the delicacies we might desire. What makes us different is not the trappings of modern civilization we all share. It's the need to be self-reliant. It's certainly possible to live here without being self-reliant, and many people are dependent on others to get by. There's certainly no shame in this. What I'm getting at is if you live in the boonies, it's best if you can not only take care of yourself, but also be able to lend a helping hand in times of need. We're seeing a lot of that right now. Roads are closed, power lines are down, and thousands of Brown County people are without electricity. The local power company has advised us to be prepared for an extended power outages because of all the damage to the lines. They won't be able to make repairs to some areas until the water recedes, and there's more rain in the forecast. It's a privilege to live here, but along with privilege comes obligation. The hills and forests are beautiful, and we all love having our own little piece of paradise. We also love being spread out. That's what makes it seem like the frontier. We live somewhere between the 21st century and the edge of the wilderness, and most of it wouldn't have it any other way. This is Dave Seastrom. See you next time.
And now we pause for station identification.
Support for WFHB and the Brown County Hour is brought to you by Plum Creek Antiques, located at the intersection of 135 and 45 in downtown Bean Blossom, where visitors can buy, sell, or trade most anything. More information is available by calling 812-988-6268. You are listening to the Brown County Hour on volunteer-powered community radio WFHB at 100.7 in Brown County, 91.3 and 98.1 in Bloomington, 106.3 in Ellettsville, and online at wfhb.org.
We'll start this segment with a discussion about forest management with arborist Rick Patrick. We also have the latest forest song with Carrie Ray.
Carol Marks shares one of her poems, and we'll hear another tune from the Boxcar Annies.
It's our pleasure to have Rick Patrick in the studio. Thank you so much for coming in, Rick.
Pleasure.
Rick is a professional arborist, and he does a lot of work with urban trees, but he is also a person that lives in Brown County and is aware of a lot of what's been going on. Part of what we want to talk about this evening is the new forest plan.
Yep, and I have to plead ignorant because I don't know everything that's going on in the forest plan, so if you could run it down for us.
Well, fortunately, there is now on the Indiana DNR website, they have published the new forest plan, so it's possible to go to that site and read it, and it's indnr.gov. But essentially, what has happened is the management system of the forest has shifted from the very first timber sales in the early 60s up until 10 years ago. The forest was managed by a 17% new growth cut rate, and each parcel was visited once in 20 years. Now, the new plan, they have increased the cut rate to 60% of new growth, which is a 1,000% increase. And each parcel will be visited not just once, but twice, and some of them three times. They're also creating a road infrastructure where they're building 30-foot wide gravel roads throughout the entire forest system as a means of permanent harvest for timber sales. And this is changing the characteristic of the forest from a wild forest land that's in a 100-year recovery into what can arguably be called tree farms. So, in the nutshell, that's pretty much what the plan is.
Oh, dear. That doesn't sound good.
Well, and I appreciate that, but you were in here last fall, and you had several things to say that I thought were excellent observations and provided good information, and one of the topics you chose was invasives. You mind refreshing our memory on some of that?
Not at all. Invasives, one of the problems with clear cutting and that sort of harvesting is that you do introduce invasives, you suppress the trees that are native to the area. It just makes it easier for the invasives to move on in. A lot of invasives are brought in via the vehicles, through the tread or whatever. They just move stuff from one site to another. You have compaction of soil. You get rid of habitat. You get rid of the native food for various animals. You change the whole complexion of the woods.
Well, one of the comments you made last fall that stuck with me is that we are seeing invasives along our roadsides and under the mm-hmm. power lines. So that That's logically right. it follows that once you've created the clear areas in the new right. forest plan, that right. the invasives will find an immediate home.
That's right. I did a walkthrough for Grandview Lake one time. Someone was convincing them that they had way too much fuel built up in their watershed area, that they needed to start logging this stuff right away and opening it up because they were going to have fires and it was going to be awful. So some of the members of the association asked me to take a walk around, and I walked. Actually, it was pretty pristine, and the forest was taking care of itself just fine. What I did find is exactly what you said. The areas where there were issues under power lines and along the roads where the soil had been disturbed from building roads or access for the power lines. The interesting thing to me was if the whole idea was fire suppression, it's like, so this guy is going to log, and he's going to be sure to grind up everything, all the brush. He's not going to leave that all behind, right? And they said, oh, well, no, he said that, you know, that would be okay. And it's like, He's actually creating fuel. He's not.
Yeah.
He's not alleviating it. So I don't buy that whole. You know, we have to clear cut everything so that we're safe from fire.
Well, and especially in a hardwood forest, they call it green asbestos, and and what that basically means is the stuff on the forest floor and some of the standing dead trees will burn, but a healthy living oak will not. You know, this is not a conifer forest.
That's right. Well, and then also that you go back to the invasives, and you know, you get multiflora rose and Japanese honeysuckle, whatever.
Autumn olive.
Yeah, autumn olive. Those are great fuel for fires. You know, it's that the understory. If you've got a mass of that, then you know your oak could potentially catch fire because the fire is not just burning through some like grassland or whatever. It's just it's burning closer to the trees and hotter and longer. So,
well, I suppose if you pour in enough fuel, I mean, even Dresden, the concrete burned because there was that much going on. In your work as an arborist, you're called on to manage urban forests, if you will. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Well, it's a little discouraging these days for me. You try, you do your best, but you know, Bloomington, Plainfield, where I grew up, you know, you look around and it's just, there's more and more growth. Concrete and lawn, people are obsessed with lawn, which is basically a green desert. It makes it difficult to have a canopy. You don't have corridors for turtles or other wildlife to go from one place to another. They're boxed in. It's just changing the way we live, the way animals live. Deer. In Bloomington, it's bad here, but Bloomington, I was pruning trees on Park Ridge East, which is just inside of Bloomington. As the limbs are hitting the ground, here comes two fawns, and they're eating the leaves off of the branches. I can't get them through the chipper. It's like, you know, let go away. And that is not natural,
right.
And it's not good. There's no predators. There's too many deer, and they're going to suffer because there's not enough food to go around. You know, I like deer as much as anybody, but there's too many deer. There's too many of us, and there's not enough wild areas for them. So you get back to the logging again. It's like, where are they supposed to live?
And the logic of removing habitat means you remove the critters that are dependent on it.
That's right. Yeah. You remove their homes. They move on, and then, you know, you've broken the cycle. It's like they all depend on each other. The trees depend on the squirrels to move the acorns around or whatever, and the squirrels depend on the trees for their food source, and we disrupt that. That's another thing I think about often is about, you know, the bumper stickers I used to see all the time out west. I haven't seen them here, but trees, America's renewable resource. And that's true if you equate a 200-year-old oak tree with 201-year-old oak trees. You've got the biomass on those 200 seedlings, 1 year old. The biomass from all those trees don't equal a limb on a 200-year-old oak. You can't say it's America's renewable resource unless, you know, you're willing to wait around 200 or 300 years and hope that nobody cuts it down in the meantime.
Well, and some of the oaks take 200, 250 years to mature, you know, which essentially means that there will be no mature oak trees in Indiana State Forest.
Nope. Well, you look around Brown County. 1980, I think, was the first year that the population got back to where it was in 1880. And a big part of that was cutting down all the trees and farming the hillsides, silting up the streams and creeks and rivers. You know, you don't see 250-year-old trees in Brown County. You might find one here and there down in a gully because it wasn't accessible or structurally it wasn't desirable. Because they had plenty of others to cut down. It's like, who needs that one? That we got all this stuff right here. It's not a renewable resource.
Well, it could be if it was managed.
If it was managed properly.
And the argument is that at the 60% new growth cut rate, we are now dipping into the principal. We're not just skimming off the interest. And I think there's a great deal of concern, even amongst former DNR employees. So
that's a great way to put it. That's a wonderful way to put it.
Thank you so much for coming in, Rick. We really appreciate it.
It's good to be here.
Welcome to For a Song. I'm your host, Carrie Ray. August is upon us, as are the dog days of summer. Summer's a busy performance season for me, which means that much of my musical bandwidth is taken with rehearsals, show prep, gear tweaking, travel, and putting on shows. Oh, and of course, picking out the right hat to wear. Besides pursuits of a musical nature, summer brings another call of nature. No, not that call of nature, but the call of Mother Nature. Berries need picking, mushrooms need to be found, fish are waiting to be caught, hikes to be made, canoes and kayaks are in need of a good paddling, bikes dream of smooth, winding Brown County byways, and trees long to have a hammock stretched between them. As sunsets are crying out to be witnessed as the bullfrogs and cicadas serenade. And did I mention that fish needed catching? Now, where were we? Oh yes, songwriting. With all of the playing and, well, playing, where do I fit that in? The truth is, I do seem to carve out less large blocks of dedicated songwriting time as summer marches on. But once you become clear to your core that you're a songwriter, like really step into it, you're always writing. It's sort of like when a computer continues to run a program in the background. It's still processing, still moving tasks and ideas forward, but not necessarily in the foreground. So you learn to trust that it's still happening. The ideas still flow in. Many times when I'm engaged in some of those summer activities like fishing, hiking, pedaling, or paddling. But for now, they're often just jotted down or quickly recorded with my cell phone to revisit later. My first record was made nearly 14 years after I wrote my first song. And in that time, I had been what I would classify a fair-weather songwriter. That's to say that I didn't really work the craft, approach the process with any sort of impetus, or even really think of myself as a songwriter. Over those years, a song would just show up now and then and practically write itself. But once I started to perform live, and the requests kept coming for CDs, I finally went into the studio and recorded Always On in 2009. For a time after that, I was working hard to put myself on the map as a singer-songwriter and recording artist. Through booking, promoting, putting and keeping a band together, and working on becoming a better musician and performer, which is ongoing, by the way. So when people started asking when the next CD would be in the works, it threw me quickly into a bit of a panic, with a splash of identity crisis. I mean, was I really a songwriter? Yes, I had written some songs, that folks seemed to like. But they just sort of happened over the course of over a decade. Now it was a year or so later and people wanted a whole new CD worth. Could I write anymore? Would they be any good? What if I had already shot my creative wad? Sometimes I still ask myself some of those questions. But the fact is, just when I think the well might be dry, another song fills it up and I breathe a little easier. So yes, songwriting is a thing you do, but a songwriter is a thing you are. And once you're clear this is who you are, you don't have to focus so much on the do. Your homework? To spend some time deciding you're a songwriter until you feel it all the way to that little warm spot in the middle of your chest. Because remember, a bell is still a bell, even when it isn't ringing. And a wren is still a wren, even when it isn't singing. I'm Carrie Ray. Join me next time on For a Song. If you have ideas, questions, or topics you would like to have covered on For a Song, please send them along. You can reach me via the contact page of my website at carrieray.com. That's CARRIRAY.com. Thanks for listening.
My name is Carol Marks, and this poem is entitled Train. There is still a freight train every day just before dawn. I can hear the whistle, high and lonesome. Easiest in winter with no muffling leaves, but even on summer mornings, that coal train fades in behind the crickets and katydids, with the rattle of the coal cars slowing for Helmsburg and then the trestle by Lake Lemon, ridges and ridges away.
Let's hear about the tune Nashville, which, Gabrielle, I understand you wrote that one.
I did. We really like Brown County, Heather and I. So this is actually the first song that I wrote for the Boxcar Annies, ironically enough. It's a funny tune. I think I wrote it last summer. I was sitting outside, and I live on a hilltop, and I was kind of sitting out there one day, and my parents back in the day were engaged at the Ordinary, and we've been coming back on my birthday every year since. So we moved around a lot when I was a kid, so I never really had one place that was home, but I could always count on coming back here to Brown County every winter, and I hold those memories dear to my heart, and you know, what town looks like at Christmas and such. So that song is about how much I love Nashville and how I feel it's really my home. Now we're rolling down a dirt road, miles of cornfields flying by. Got my baby by my right side, and he is looking fine. And we're headed down to Nashville, gonna catch ourselves a tune. And my baby plays the guitar, and he'll play all
And now we pause for station identification.
Support for WFHB and the Brown County Hour is brought to you by Plum Creek Antiques, located at the intersection of 135 and 45 in downtown Bean Blossom, where visitors can buy, sell, or trade most anything. More information is available by calling 812-988-6268. You are listening to the Brown County Hour on volunteer-powered community radio WFHB at 100.7 in Brown County, 91.3 and 98.1 in Bloomington, 106.3 in Ellettsville, and online at wfhb.org.
We'll kick off the final segment with the community calendar, followed by a discussion on invasive plants with Ruth Ann Ingram.
Gunther Flum will share another fine poem with us, and we'll wind it up with another tune from the Boxcar Annies. Welcome to the Brown County Community Calendar for the month of August. On Monday, the 3rd, there's a presentation at the History Center's monthly dinner about founding father Jacob Brown at 6:30 p.m. Saturday, the 8th, from 5 to 8 p.m., is the Art Walk in downtown Nashville. Thursday, the 13th, at 6:30 p.m., the community conversation at the library will discuss the park, the trails, and Old Town Nashville. On Saturday, the 22nd, Chateau Thomas Winery will host another Partake event. There's a blues festival at Bill Monroe Music Park from the 27th through the 29th. The Farmers Market at St. David's Episcopal Church in Bean Blossom is from 4 to 7 p.m. on Fridays. And finally, the History Center is open Tuesday through Friday from 1 to 4. The Pioneer Village is open Saturday and Sunday from 1 to 4, and the archives are also open from 1 to 4 p.m. on Tuesdays and Fridays. This has been the Brown County Community Calendar for August 2015.
It's our pleasure to introduce you to Ruth Ann Ingram, and she's here to discuss invasive plant species in Brown County. Hi, Ruth Ann.
How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for coming in. So, how big a problem is it, and what really talking about with these plants?
Depends on the plant how big a problem it is. There's going to be an article in the Democrat in a week or two about a plant that many of us wouldn't think of as an invasive species, but it's the ornamental grass, which is the official name is Miscanthus sinensis, which we're beginning to see along the roadsides. We love our ornamental grasses, right? So many people have them in their yards and in their landscape. And one of the sort of the low end of an upward curve. So now is the time to look for Miscanthus sinensis, remove it from our gardens, and plant a different kind of grass. So there are those that are sort of just on the cusp of perhaps just getting loose and going crazy. A common invasive species that we're all familiar with, I'm sure, in Brown County is the Japanese honeysuckle, which is the vining honeysuckle that smells so good in the summertime. The fragrance of Japanese honeysuckle is amazing, but you probably know how it grows over the ground and up the fences and up the trees. That's kind of beyond help, you might say. But there's some things that are not beyond help, and that's why the Brown County Native Woodlands was founded and formed in 2006. And so Brown County Native Woodlands Project, the intention of that is to protect our forests from invasive species. An invasive species can actually change an entire environment and become a monoculture. The classic invasive species in this country, I think, is kudzu. And as you may know, we have at least a dozen sites in Brown County of kudzu. They're well over 100 statewide, and it's even into Michigan. That's the classic example of a plant that has gone totally bonkers, introduced to help avoid erosion when they did road cuts, and it did that and a whole lot more.
I always thought kudzu was susceptible to cold weather.
It lives in Indiana.
Wow.
Yes. And we monitor it for the state of Indiana. The Brown County Native Woodlands Project monitors it.
Part of your focus is to maintain a healthy forest.
Exactly.
What are the implications from the massive increase in the timber cutting right now in terms of invasive species in our state forest lands?
I'm not sure that the timbering has made that much of a difference in invasive species. If the logging companies use best management practices, then there should not be an increase in invasive species. I'm thinking of Yellowwood State Forest at this very moment, and years ago, seeing the prevalence of vinca, which is also called periwinkle, in the state forest. I don't know how long ago that was introduced, but certainly I would say at best 25, 30, maybe 40 years ago. And there are acres there. That had nothing to do with the logging, as far as I know, although I can't speak to the history of it in Yellowwood State Forest. I simply know that there are acres of it, and the problem with so many invasive species, if you let it go and if you don't get it right at the beginning, as we're talking about the miscanthus, the Chinese silver grass, then it can get away from you and it becomes too expensive, too labor intensive to get rid of. And I would say vinca falls into that category, the vinca in Yellowwood State Forest. How are you going to get rid of acres of vinca?
If there was one thing that you feel is most important for anyone that lives in this area, what would it be?
In regard to invasive species?
Yes.
Learn to recognize them when they're young, when they're first sprouting. And, you know, and you can find that online, certainly. I also would advise probably one of our most important educational tools would be Nature Days. And there's several people in this room, six of us. Has anyone else attended Nature Days at Camp Rancho Fremasa or Bill and Becky Freeman's place before that? That's a free day. It's always the first Saturday after Labor Day. And at Camp Rancho Fremasa, lunch included. And it's a great way of not only learning about invasive species, which is an important thing, and how to recognize them, but also how to be, in general, good stewards of our land. And in this case, being a good steward of our properties is certainly involves watching out for invasive species and remove them.
Well, Ruth Ann, thank you very much for coming in this evening. I really appreciate
it. You're so welcome. It's my pleasure.
The Great Brown County Garbage War by Gunther Flum. Now, we all thought it mighty weird when all the possums disappeared. None were dead upon the street. None were there for folks to eat. None were there for folks to wear. There were no possums anywhere. It was just as we all feared as all our possums disappeared. Now, folks all wondered what the cause, but when we passed them critter laws, when everyone had cast their vote, the chances were, but seemed remote, that there would be a full migration as possums set up their own nation in the county right next door and then declared themselves at war. Since now the possums knew their chances of hanging out amongst the branches would just get worse with every hour if them raccoons now held the power in the fields and in the wood because Brown County said they could. Now, we could tell right from the start that them raccoons was mighty smart, as every trash can in the county after midnight was a bounty of full of garbage raccoons seen, as in the darkness fine cuisine. But possums had the same desire, which daily caused their nightly ire, since possums felt they had the right to eat our garbage every night, and so both had us in a stew, so what was we supposed to do? Now in the county where we're from, the only critter really dumb who in the brain case missed the bus just so happens to be us, since in the forest we're the fools who must have clothing, fire, and tools. And so we figured to be wise, we would try to help these guys in the future with their plans to nightly raid our garbage cans. And so we thought to be a sport, we'd take them critters both to court and let a jury pick the winner who at night can eat our dinner. To get a jury of their peers, we had to let them folks drink beers and turn them loose and for a lark open trash cans in the dark just so they could get the feel for what them critters had to steal. Then let them sober up a while and pick them for their guts and style, but most of them seemed in a hurry to get themselves recused from jury. Now first the possum's lawyer said, "There's nothing in the possum's head that forces folks across the land to have to keep their garbage canned. Since everybody knows the score, they've been here since the dinosaur, and they admit that they ain't smart to take a garbage can apart. And they admit that, to their shame, it were raccoons that were to blame." Now, raccoons knew the consequences of putting up their own defenses. Besides, they had the daunting task of why they always wear a mask and why the stripes upon their tail had left them tailor-made for jail, as all the raccoons knew their plight was dining in the dark at night. And so their lawyers made their case that nightly in the garbage race, it's true the raccoons always won, but after all the damage done, it were the possums, raccoons knew, who came in as a cleanup crew. And so they figured it was fair if they spread the possum's share upon the steps and in the yard so possums they won't find it hard to pick through garbage on the lawn before the humans wake at dawn. And so we're happy to report that them two settled out of court, so possums moved back to the county as raccoons left them all their bounty. But you remember at the start I said raccoons was mighty smart, and so they made a nightly plan to upset every garbage can and thus create a mother load to lure them possums across the road. So on our highways and on our street, they've left us possums there to eat. But just because they're legal, I notice they don't taste no better. Yours truly, Gunther Flum.
Tell me about the tune, Show Me.
It is.
A kind of risque tune.
It is. I've always been pretty comfortable singing bluesy stuff, and I was like, well, what the hell, might as well write a bluesy song. So I tried it out, and my dad felt kind of awkward because of some of the lyrics that are in it, and I was trying to get him to help me with it, which he did end up putting in a couple lyrics in the song for me. But it's actually about the man I'm with now. Before I was with him, there was just something about him that I couldn't get over, and so I wrote about it, and it's basically about wanting to get to know him and seeing where things go.
So this song created some kind of voodoo attraction.
It works, let
it
me
works.
Tell
That's
you.
That's scary.
They're
that
damn cute,
really
too.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to episode 41 of the Brown County Hour, recorded in our studio at the History Center here in downtown Nashville, and brought to you the first Sunday of every month at 9 a.m. and the following Wednesday at 6 p.m. You can stream this or any of our shows from our website, browncountyhour.com. While you're there, be sure to check out our Woodwatch page devoted to informing the public about the dire situation our forest lands are facing. This show was produced by Jeff Foster, Pam Rader, Rick Fettig, Vera Grubbs, and Dave Seastrom, with special guest host Kerry Ray. Our show would not be complete without our theme music from Silas Klug. Thanks, buddy. You've been listening to the Brown County Hour,
coming to you from deep in the woods of Brown County, Indiana.
Celebrating the arts, culture, and nature that make this such a unique community.
Visit us online at browncountyhour.com.
The Brown County Hour is a production of WFHB.
Volunteer-powered, listener-supported community radio for South Central Indiana.
Take me back to my home, Brown County home.